Today's program is brought to you by the Dairy Farm Families of Wisconsin, the Wisconsin Milk Marketing Board. Did you know that today Wisconsin produces more than 600 varieties, types, and styles of American, international style, and original cheese that win more awards than any other state or country? To learn more, visit eatwisconsincheese.com.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. We're a member-supported food radio network, broadcasting over 35 weekly shows live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. Join our hosts as they lead you through the world of craft brewing, behind the scenes of the restaurant industry, inside the battle over school food, and beyond. Find us at heritageradionetwork.org.
Hello, this is Diane Stemple on Cutting the Curd for Heritage Radio Network. I am, well, not in the studio, but actually in my apartment with Bronwyn Percival and Frances Percival about their new book, which is just amazing and setting fire to the cheese world, Reinventing the Wheel, Milk, Microbes, and the Fight for Real Cheese. Welcome.
Thanks very much. It's great to be here.
Hello. Yes. Welcome.
So, you are on a book tour.
Yes, no, we're very excited to be on the first of four trips to the United States between now and November.
I have been a little bit crazy with organizing our schedule.
Is that your job?
Yes, absolutely. I'm in charge of scheduling and marketing. And we are hitting 27 cities for almost 50 events in the United States.
I am delighted to have gotten you for this interview and for this show because this seems like such an important cheese book.
Well, thank you very much. We're really, really excited to have the chance to get the ideas out there.
Yes, yes. So anyway, I'm always curious about the writing process. What book did you set out to write?
So, a book in many ways, we are married. We've been married now for 10 years in November.
I noticed you had the same last name.
Yes,
exactly. That was a tip-off.
Isn't it a coincidence that I write with my sister? Yes, as I tell the groupies. This starts out very much as a continuation of a discussion that really was part of our very first date.
Where
we were both these sorts of larval creatures very early in our careers, and I was in almost complete ignorance of the cheese world. I was involved with cooking and otherwise a wine guy.
Right.
And Bronwyn had just started working with Niels Gard Dairy. She'd already she'd made cheese at Baba Link and had been done some interesting work in Senegal when she was in the Peace Corps. We had this, it wasn't quite an argument, but it was an interesting, just before we sat down for dinner on our first date, and it was a discussion about cheddar. And Bronwyn pointed out to me that cheddar is a verb as well as a noun, that cheddaring is a process. Now, I was in complete ignorance. I didn't realize this at all at the time. Whereas I was essentially maintaining to, no, but cheddar is a place. Cheddar must always taste of the place where it's from, and isn't this an abomination that all these other countries make cheddar?
Well, at least you had, you know, a step up from some people.
But you got a second date.
I got a second date. Because I paid, I know. And so it's that sort of discussion of bringing some of those values of the wine industry and some of the concepts that were already formed in what I was doing, and essentially over the marital kitchen table, poking Bronwyn
at each other, and
saying, "Why isn't your industry
more like mine?
More like mine."
That's a great origin. But that's like how many years ago?
That must have been 12 years ago.
Okay. Yes. Okay. Yeah. So then when do things develop?
So having had so many arguments and having Frances work more and more within the world of wine, we ultimately went and worked a vintage with our friends in Burgundy. And that, for me, was really a moment of truth. That we visited this. I took a one-month vacation from Niels Gard Dairy. We went to
Europe. Is a wonderful place to work.
I'm sure.
Plenty of vacation time.
Right, right.
But it allowed us to go together and spend harvest at this farm and see a world in which farmers were not only paid extremely well for growing interesting things, but were also superstars. Mm-hmm. And, you know, all of these things that Francis had been saying to me about why isn't the cheese world more like wine suddenly hit home to me that actually here's an agricultural product that is adding value and making great sustainable farming actually financially interesting as well. Mm-hmm. And mm-hmm. the more and more that we thought about applying those ideas to cheese and where cheese, the cheese industry could potentially have those conversations, but they weren't necessarily happening yet. That really was the genesis of this book.
Well, I think the interesting thing was that was immediately followed by Bronwyn having the chance to work for a couple of months in what was then Rachel Dutton and Ben Wolfe's lab at Harvard, working on cheese rind microbiology, on the microbial ecosystems within cheese, and the combination of those two impulses of the
science,
scientific understanding,
right. the farming system,
with,
right,
and all,
right.
there were things here to think about and ultimately to write about, and it was just, it seemed like such an interesting moment for cheese that it was this great opportunity to just have the discipline to put all of these ideas down on paper and sort out all of them for ourselves.
Okay. Now, was there a proposal or did a publisher approach you or did you approach them?
I think our agent has still not forgiven us for the book that I think she had in mind was the sort of a very nice book, a sort of a run through either as an expose of naughty things in the cheese industry, or of as a collection of wonderful bucolic tales of isn't cheese
farms,
interesting?
Yes.
And what she's got is the book that we really wanted to write,
right.
which is this.
Well,
interest.
It's a political treatise.
Yeah. It's a manifesto.
I mean,
it
even touches on our issues today even more so than when you were probably writing it.
Little did we know.
It's like blossoms. The section on cognitive.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
The way in which our values construct the way that we process data.
Right.
I'd
never heard of that guy, Cahan.
Yes.
From
Yale Law
from
School.
Yale.
Yeah.
And it was like, oh my God, he's explaining why we can't talk to each
exactly.
other.
Exactly. And also, even more importantly, a route that maybe we could rephrase the same ideas in a way that regulators I'd actually want to listen to.
Right. Okay. So your publisher... did you have financing for these trips, or did you self-finance?
There was a small advance, which rapidly got spent, and it's one of the disadvantages of working together.
You take a lot of trips.
And I think we were very lucky that for one of our trips, for the trip to Denmark to research starter cultures, actually the Culinary Historians of New York gave us a very generous grant, and so we've come and we've given a big presentation for them. But that was great support.
Right.
And other than that, really, this was something we absolutely passionately believed in,
and we wanted to do, and actually was really enriching. And I would spend my money and my vacation time our time doing these things.
Anyway. You had a very excellent, interesting time in every place, even if you didn't agree with the people.
Yes.
Yes.
Even more so if we didn't agree with people, because that gave us stuff to talk to, to think about.
Right,
yeah.
Right. So this is a must-read book for everyone in the cheese community. It is well-written, incredibly well-researched, and covers many very serious topics. When asked, what is this book about? What's the answer?
I think I'll give my answer, and then Francis can give his answer.
Two answers.
We actually agree. I tell people that it is about looking back to go forward. It's about how cheese has changed in the last century and a half, and how the forces of progress have in many ways unbalanced systems that were working really, really well, that our great-grandparents had developed just by dint of experience over time, and how it's only now with the help of really cutting-edge science that we can start to understand how they were right and maybe put together some of these things that we've lost into a new generation of cheeses that are the expressions of real farming systems.
Absolutely. I would say it's about the history, the science, and the future, and how the future is the synthesis of the history and the science of cheese making and of dairy farming, and yes, that whole project of putting the agriculture back in to cheese. Okay. Of how, I think when we have the conversation about cheese, when I compare it with my own work in the wine industry, if you visit a winemaker, the first thing they want you to see, they will take you out into the vineyards, and they will, the conceit within the industry, possibly even too much, is that wine is made in the vineyard. And I would love more cheesemakers, when we visit them, to take us out
take us to the cows and
talk about that.
Now, how did the title, when did the title come about? Reinventing the wheel.
It was pretty early on, and we were arguing about it, and we knew we had to. We were thinking maybe we should just call it real cheese, but then what does that even mean? And we were trying to come up with puns, and it was, you know, it was sort of like revolving the, you know, and I had a brilliant moment of insight in our kitchen, and I said, I know what we're going to call the book. And so Reinventing the Wheel was clear the moment it came.
Oh, and
Bronwyn's
like
best
it?
Quality is her humility, yeah.
You just can't get over the fact that I was the one who...
I was responsible for the subtitle to actually gloss it.
Oh,
I think
good.
Reinventing the Wheel, our translators in other languages slightly resent it because it works as brilliantly as a concept with it, because it's a pun in English.
Okay.
And if you're trying to turn it into Russian.
It
doesn't work as well because they don't call a cheese
a wheel,
and they don't have this
so
expression.
So what did you
of,
have to call it?
It's, we haven't yet heard from the translator what they've called it, but it's yeah.
That's interesting. I didn't think of that. Now, who wrote what, or did you do it actually together, or did you separate?
We
chapters?
Started out. this is a.
I don't want to start a marital spat.
The marital spat has already been had. Believe me. We started out writing the proposal, working together on either side of the table with a Google Docs document open, and that did not work very well. I was too quick to correct the spellings while the word was still being typed, and it was just, that was too immediate a collaboration.
Okay.
In the end, we ended up working on the proposal together and really mapping out what each chapter was going to be about, and then with each one of those chapters, they're different sections, and we split them up and basically assigned them to ourselves based on what we were most in the position to write, and then we spliced them back together, and Francis added the jokes.
I think
he's the jokester. But the jokes are often about you.
Uh-oh.
Not about you, but more.
I think one of the interesting things is where it's the narrative of Bronwyn's family and of Bronwyn's life.
Yeah.
I wrote almost all of those sections myself.
Okay. But you say in the book that Bronwyn's family doesn't get your jokes.
That is a true statement that has been fact-checked and signed off
by everyone.
When you mention people by name, you have to get a waiver, so there is a... I think one of the... If you like playing the literary sleuth, one of the interesting things is to read the book and try and see where the joins happen.
I couldn't tell. I think you're both must be really good writers. And but every once in a while there's something sort of majestic that I would say, where did that sentence come from?
Sham Augustan prose is definitely the
that's from your side. Okay, now, I just want to tell the listeners who, many of whom haven't seen or read the book yet, that these are some of the chapter titles: breed, feed, microbes, risk, cultures, families and factories. So you kind of know that it's a really serious book, but you split it up in a really interesting way, not just chronological. So how did you pick your chapters? Did anything really important get left out?
I think this was one of the most interesting decisions during the actual drafting process of the book. The first half of the book in its totality started out initially in the plans as the first chapter. And that It expanded and we realized that the 30,000 word first chapter was not really something that we could live with. And then finding the logical divisions. I agree. If it was a pure work of history, then a chronological approach would have been more logical.
Right.
But because we wanted to slice it thematically so that it would tally with the science, we've already talked about, a little bit about some of the ideas with risk, bringing in things like cultural cognition and cost-benefit analysis. And that makes sense in a chapter about risk, but doesn't position itself, because we're not just telling the story of pasteurization or of disciplining milk.
Right.
We're telling this. So each chapter is centered initially initially in our drafting, was centered around an individual cheese that we felt was the perfect example of the issues involved within that. It's become a little bit foggier in the actual finishing of the...
Because to me, the titles were really good in terms of... And I think it'd be good for readers who just want to read one section. Yeah. They can read a chapter and get a full idea of what you're talking about.
Absolutely. No, I do think it works well as a serial work as well, that you don't have to start at the beginning and read straight to the end. And if you get bogged down in the microbiology chapter and it's all just too much, it's absolutely fine to skip on to the next one and start from the
And I mean, in terms of discipline, it is a work of synthesis. So each chapter concentrates within a different discipline. So yes, there is the microbiology chapter, which is dealing with microbiology, but the breed chapter is about breed genetics, the practicalities of breed, of breeding dairy animals, and it's a very, very different set of disciplines. And it was interesting for us sharing this work with experts, who would very often comment that they were expert on one chapter.
Right, but not the others.
And then not the others. And it was one of the challenges was finding people to read, to check, to chase up.
Yeah, that's
true. Who had the breadth to be able to follow through everything.
Right. And I think also people pop up in different chapters. So it's kind of nice to see, oh, I know this person already.
Yeah.
So he or she is back. Mm-hmm. So that's kind of cool, too. It weaves it well.
Yeah.
Okay, so... it occurs to me that this book is more than a dissertation. It really is. And the most similar cheese book that I can think of is Heather Paxson's The Life of Cheese. Mm-hmm. Did you feel that?
We are great admirers of Heather's work, and certainly the whole...
But you disagree with her.
In some ways. And those two things are not mutually exclusive. But
And there's no reason for them to be.
No, right. Absolutely. And I think what our goal with this was to do is to write something that's not just academically robust, but also a fun read. And also was the great challenge, that if we put people, if we put people in an academic mindset and make them feel like they're doing a homework assignment in the library, then we have absolutely failed.
Mm-hmm.
That what we want to do is synthesize all of these different disciplines and then turn this into a story that actually has relevance, not just to the world of cheese, but also to agriculture, sustainability of our food system.
Mm-hmm. And also something that has global relevance, because where Heather's is very much a work of ethnography within a distinct community within, largely the northeastern United States, we wanted to be able to have relevance to Europe,
to France,
to England, to Australia.
Because in many ways, the French can learn a lot from the English and the Americans.
They may not know it.
They may not know it. It's not just...
Just being a, anti-French person.
No.
Even though I love French cheese.
Absolutely. And French cheese succeeds dramatically in some ways and fails miserably in others.
Yeah, that was interesting. Now, okay, the cheese crush. Hosea Twombly?
Yes.
Is that how you say
Josiah.
It?
Josiah.
Oh, Josiah.
He's a very old school name.
So now, who found him? Who's got the crush on him? And of course, I love the sluttish nastiness that he calls... What does he call sluttish nastiness?
So, when dairy maids don't keep their dairies clean, they are bastions of sluttish nastiness. And I remember I was reading this this book. There's so much that's available digitized now in terms of old manuscripts, but the whole book is printed in with the old long F sort
It's a book. It's not early modern.
Says the historian. Tell me what font that this book is.
But it's printed in the late 18th century. So the second edition, which is the key interesting adjustments and editorial changes, late 1780s. And this is someone who has essentially the same job that Bronwyn, as the cheese buyer for Neal's Yard Dairy, has now.
He is
a cheese factor.
That's what it's called.
Exactly. Oh, okay. And I think Bronwyn's new next set of business cards from Neal's Yard Dairy will say cheese factor on them. That his job is essentially to go and to visit farms and to select cheese, to taste cheese with the dairy maids, with the people making the cheese, and then select the cheese he wants to buy it, and then bring it back to London and sell it at profit in London.
Amazing.
He's a figure who's drawn much attention from historians, largely because he is quite robust in how he expresses his opinions. There's a little bit of the sort of the Donald Trump about how he doesn't quite call people sad losers and haters, but he calls them sluts. And so there is a strand, and once you're doing the sort of the initial literature search for dairy history, and for particularly in terms of the acquisition of expertise, how do you acquire the knowledge that you need to be able to make the cheese? And there is a protracted debate amongst gender historians about his work. So there was one of the classic papers was published in a history journal, essentially around Josiah Twombly, saying essentially he is a very bad man. We entirely disagree with this because he actually has tremendous respect for the cheesemakers of England.
Yeah, he's saying back then what you'd like to hear now.
No,
exactly.
Absolutely. Which is amazing.
And he even dedicated the second edition of his book to the dairy women of Great Britain, without whom he would never have been able to gain the knowledge that it took to write the book.
What I really hope is that in 200 years' time, there's a professor at Columbia University and says, Bronwyn and Francis Percival, they're really bad influences. They're bringing...
So judgmental.
Right, but we're bringing them back.
And I think the really nice thing in the US, you really are blessed with some amazing food-centric cookbook stores.
Yes.
Places like Kitchen Arts and Letters in New York, like Omnivore Books in San Francisco. And one of those specialists, Rabelais Books up in Maine, is a specialist antiquarian book dealer. And we bumped into Don at the Oxford Symposium this year, and he didn't have the second edition that we were really chasing up, but he had a third edition. and so my gift to Bronwyn to celebrate the, because Josiah Twombly is very much Bronwyn's cheese crush.
She
reads through this book and sees someone saying exactly the same things she thinks about the producers
exciting.
With whom she works.
Yeah.
And so I was able to buy for Bronwyn
as a surprise.
As a gift.
Very nice. A good husband.
Yeah.
He's a good husband.
He has his moments.
Okay, let's take a break. This is Diane Stemple, Cutting the Curd. We're discussing reinventing the cheese. And reinventing the wheel, and with Bronwyn Percival and her husband Francis.
Today's program is brought to you by the Wisconsin Milk Marketing Board. Wisconsin produces the world's best cheese, period. Why? Lush grasslands, glacial water supply, fourth-generation cheesemakers, combining old-world tradition with the new ideas and highest standards. The very best milk. What do you think of when you think of Wisconsin cheese? For me, I think cheese curds. Delicious, fresh cheese curds, or deep-fried cheese curds. Cheese curds literally any way, anytime, any place. I think about Andy Hatch and Upland's Cheese Company, the operation behind the Pleasant Ridge Reserve cheese that's literally America's most awarded cheese. I think of the deliciously stinky Limburger and its long-storied history. I think about Raleigh's Dumbarton Blue, a perfect blend of English-style cheddar and notes of blue. I think of Emmy Roth's Grand Cru Sirchois, which was named 2016's World Champion at the World Championship Cheese Contest. Wisconsin is like the world champion of cheese, and once you start reading the list of cheeses made in Wisconsin on their website, you can see why. The Wisconsin Milk Marketing Board is a nonprofit organization funded entirely by Wisconsin's dairy farm families. Read more at eatwisconsincheese.com, and as soon as you're done listening to this podcast, eat Wisconsin cheese. It's a no-brainer.
Okay, so it's funny that you said that cheeses informed the chapters, because what immediately hooked me as I'm starting to read online before the book came was the Salers.
Oh, yeah.
Am I saying it right?
Yeah, I mean, half of the French people say Salers and half of people say Salers, so
oh,
I think
okay.
Both are
okay,
right. Yeah.
Okay, so I think I ran across it before... when I was already in love with cheese, but before I had started any cheese career, at L'Ambassade d'Auvergne, mm-hmm. and it was like, why do I like this cheese so much? I don't like Cantal. Mm-hmm. Like, what's going on? And so can you talk about the Salers, and did that start the book?
In a way, I think that Salers didn't necessarily prompt us to start writing the book, but... when we went with the scientist, Marie-Christine Montel, to visit the Salers producer, we really recognized how, in a single cheese, it synthesized this idea of tasting a farming system. Mm-hmm. And the truth about Salers, I mean, the thing that's so amazing about it is that it is only as good as the sum of its parts. You can have amazing milk produced in an amazing way and then have production that's a little bit out of tune. Maybe they leave too much moisture in their curd, mm-hmm. or they don't get mm-hmm. it acid enough. And it can be rank.
Mm-hmm.
Some of the
okay.
Salers on the market is essentially inedible.
Oh, okay.
But when it's made well, and when the milk is really on form, which I think is a lot of, you know, is the case for a lot of these cheeses,
mm-hmm.
then I think it reaches a level of, like, clarity of flavor and expression and depth and complexity
mm-hmm.
that really is what we're thinking about as the essential...
as what you want
yeah.
cheese to go towards.
Yeah, and what
mm-hmm.
many cheeses in the past, it represents the sort
mm-hmm.
of cheese making where the microbes come from the process, come from the environment, that they're
mm-hmm.
not the products of a biotechnology company,
right.
but that they really
right.
are what has evolved mm-hmm. to work within the system.
Mm-hmm.
And thinking about if we could take those ideas and apply them in other contexts, and that's not to say that every cheese should be like Salers, anything,
mm-hmm.
but Salers is the answer to a particular set of questions in a particular place. But the underlying themes, how do we harness the microbiome of the farm? How do we make those flavors manifest in those cheeses that are made there?
Mm-hmm.
How can we make cheese taste out of cheeses made nowhere else on earth?
Right.
That
right.
really is the essential cheese.
Absolutely. But I think looking back at the inception of the book, I think that Salers, and particularly Marie-Christine Montel's work
mm-hmm.
on Salers, was instrumental, because back in 2012, when Bronwyn first launched her conference on the science of artisan cheese,
mm-hmm.
a conference that brings together researchers, scientists, with primary practitioners, with
mm-hmm.
cheese makers, with
mm-hmm.
cheese regulators, bringing everyone together in the room to hear about the latest scientific research.
Mm-hmm.
It was about the gel. It was
right,
about
right, right.
this idea. So I think it's probably
well,
important that we tell the
yes,
listeners about
it. Yes, tell us about that.
So Salers is... almost, I think the way to imagine it is it's like the Grand Cru of Cantal. So
mm-hmm.
this ancient cheese of the Auvergne, of the mountains of the Massif Central in central France. And so Salers is also, it's the cheese, but it's also the breed of animal.
Mm-hmm.
And they are these magnificent, red, hardy, built like a tank cows.
Mm-hmm.
Only 5% of them are actually milked. Most of them are used as beef animals.
Mm-hmm.
Interestingly, a lot of them go to Italy for vitellone, for sort of roast veal.
Mm.
They are astonishingly rugged animals, mm-hmm. and they're basically designed, you can turn them out at the beginning of summer up to the top of the mountain. They will eat and thrive on a diet of exactly on a diet, and you come back in the autumn and you count how many you've got, and you've probably got some more.
Yeah.
And that essentially is what they're designed for. Uh-huh. And the interesting conceit of them is that they don't release their milk unless they're in the presence of their calves.
Right, I thought that was so sweet.
No, it is amazing.
So sweet. So they have to hook up the cow and keep the calf
there.
So they can milk them.
Exactly, and it means that instead of pre-dipping or post-dipping or whatever complicated thing for cleaning the udder a dairy farmer might do, essentially they just work the calf across each teat, which is nature's way to clean a teat. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. They then milk in the middle of the field, and this is where Marie-Christine Montel's research really came in.
Yeah.
Instead of adding a starter culture, the milk is transferred to a wooden barrel, a wooden sort of small vat,
which
called
is
a gel.
I didn't know how to pronounce that.
Gel.
Gel.
And it's, let's spell it. G-E-R... L-E-S?
Okay.
And the interesting thing about these
How
these
big
barrels,
are they? They can be different sizes.
Oh,
so
okay.
The smallest ones might hold 40 or 50 liters, and the largest maybe 100 200 liters.
They're designed for two people to carry, so that
they very rarely
they have sort of holes so you can put them, you can
sort of like a sedan chair.
Exactly. You can carry them like a sedan. Exactly.
Okay.
And the interesting thing about them is they never see a cleaning chemical.
Right.
The best producers, all they ever do is they rinse them out with some of the whey from cheese production. And
so now, wasn't this challenge?
Absolutely, because you can imagine
freaking out.
The French
we'll
public health regulators, when you say, so you have a dirty barrel that you put your milk in, which is already contains a cocktail of sort of calf spit that I'm not entirely happy with. And then you don't add any starter culture. And so, wow, cool, right, this is great.
And it tastes delicious.
Yes. And they really were, they were subject to scrutiny, and you can imagine there's a lot for a public health regulator to be sceptical about. And the producers were terrified. There are only five remaining producers of C'est la Tradition.
Mm-hmm.
And so they picked up the bat phone.
Mm-hmm.
Or they shone the bat signal into the sky, and Marie-Christine is the call of last resort for French cheesemakers who have microbiological problems or who have challenges from their regulators.
Mm-hmm.
She is a government scientist,
mm-hmm.
but her research group at Aurillac, at the INRA, the French government agronomy research organization.
Mm-hmm.
Does amazing work, and they have the perfect integration of a test lab for cheese making where they can make small batches in very controlled fashion of their local cheeses,
mm-hmm.
with a pretty cutting edge microbiology lab,
yeah.
sort of, and
mm-hmm.
it's stacked up, so
okay.
one is on top of the other, and they're perfectly integrated.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know if Roman wants to talk about the biofilms on these gel that they discovered.
I mean, basically, what Marie-Christine and her team found was that when they brought this gel back to the lab and they added sterile milk to it, it was acting as a natural starter factory. That within 30 seconds, they were getting high levels of inoculation of lactic acid bacteria, ripening bacteria, everything that was needed to make Salers cheese.
Mm-hmm.
And the health authorities said, that's great, but what happens if you have Listeria in your milk or Staph aureus
mm-hmm.
in your milk?
Mm-hmm.
These things are going to happen. You're milking in the middle of the field.
Mm-hmm.
So what happens then? And so because they had this brilliantly outfitted research unit, they were in a position to be able to do those experiments in the lab. And they took milk and they inoculated it with
mm-hmm.
no levels of Listeria, a whole range of pathogens.
Mm-hmm.
And they made cheeses with that.
Mm-hmm.
And then they came back and they tested the cheeses when they were ripe and ready to sell.
And this is an amazing result.
It was amazing because science seldom gives results
right,
that are so
right.
crystal clear.
Right.
But in each case, the natural microbial inhabitants of that biofilm had in there, they had outcompeted the pathogens to the extent where the cheeses were absolutely within EU standards for eating. The Listeria had been completely eradicated from the cheese.
Right.
Now, part of that is also the fact that they're making a hard-aged cheese.
Right.
Salers is
right.
quite a microbiologically robust cheese to begin with. But this is a system that developed over, you know, thousands of
years. So it naturally developed to kill off the bad stuff and to promote the good stuff and be incredibly tasty.
And it's beautiful microbiology in action.
Right.
And the fact that it came about without anyone even knowing that they existed is the particularly amazing thing. The modern mentality of cheese producers and of regulators asked the question, okay, well, this is great. We have these magical gerl. Why don't we just take these gerl, which have these wonderful natural starter producing activity, and then ask our producers to put pasteurized milk, and then the gerl will provide all of the good stuff, and then you completely eliminate any risk whatsoever.
But that
didn't work. So after, it worked for a couple of batches, but with successive batches of pasteurized milk going into the gerl, the microbial biofilm started to degrade.
It ruined it.
They became unbalanced, and suddenly you were seeing all of these gram-negative and spoilage bacteria as part of those microbial communities rather than the overwhelming preponderance of all of the right bacteria for making cheese. So it essentially depended on
the raw milk
to maintain its balance.
And I think making cheese twice a day as well, or making curd twice a day. And it's one of those things, if there's a lot of curiosity amongst some Anglo-Saxon cheesemakers about, wooden vessels, wouldn't this be an interesting way to claim our own uniqueness? Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
But you have to commit to
that
cheesemaking system.
You can't dabble in it.
You can't make cheese twice a week. We're going to do this twice a day.
Right.
The Salers producers have highly elaborate systems for how they season the gel at the beginning of the production season.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, that was just a great way to start off the book. You know, like, yay, research can be on our side.
Yes, absolutely. It completely inverts this typical story of scientists coming in and undermining or ruining or stopping traditional practice.
Here
the scientists are saving it.
Right. Now, I did like a quote from a bad guy. If I want a microbe in my cheese, I'll put it there myself.
Yeah, you know, I wouldn't say a bad guy. I would say someone who
exists scientist
within a very modern way of making cheese. This is actually a cheesemaker.
Oh, okay.
And the way he sees his cheese is
he wants to control it. Right.
And it's fair enough. He turns out a very consistent cheese, and in his mind, that is because he is wiping the slate clean and putting back those microbes that he wants there. In reality, if you look at the rind of this cheese, it is covered with uninoculated microbes. So we have the story that we tell, and then we have the reality that's going on in the background.
And in to some extent, in his defense, or at least to understand his position, that is an attitude I see a lot across multiple different fermented food and drink systems. If you have a really old school Davis trained US winemaker in California, they will say something very, very similar to you,
I want to have complete control
over the microbial constituents
balance
of my of my product.
Okay, well, that's interesting. Now, I want to skip ahead to talk a little bit about the woman, Edith Cannon, and Tom Calver wants to recreate her old cheese. Can you tell me a little bit about Edith and then how he wants to do it again?
Absolutely. So this is really, it's an interesting story because right now in Somerset, we have three remaining raw milk farmhouse Somerset cheddar producers. But if you look back 130 years, there were hundreds of them. And they had all of the infrastructure that a thriving industry needed. Dairy schools, dairy teachers, consultants, and even scientists. And the Bath and West Society hired, actually, in the 1890s, a scientist from London to come down and participate in the Cheddar School, and essentially to bring his scientific apparatus to measure the things that were going on within the cheesemaking process, and essentially to help those cheesemakers get better results mm-hmm. by understanding their cheese so that they could compete with American factory cheddar.
Which was coming over in droves.
Absolutely.
And getting better
and
or
getting
better enough to
yeah.
eat.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. So he was paired up with Edith Cannon, who was this
Now,
prodigy.
What's his name?
His name was Frederick J. Lloyd,
okay.
F.J. Lloyd.
Okay.
And so Lloyd and Edith Cannon were paired up, and she was the instructor at the Somerset Cheese School.
And is she 19?
And she was 19 when they started working
years
together.
Old.
In terms of how we, my plan for us actually to derive sort of the big cash windfall from this book is my erotic fiction that I will write,
oh,
50
about...
Shades of Way, about the very sort of
featuring
stiff starch aprons. And because there's an agent, he's in his late 30s
yes.
when
yes,
he comes
yes.
down.
Oh,
she's
oh,
in,
oh,
and
yes.
I mean, I can see it pitching
oh,
now.
Me
Eddie
too.
Redmayne, Daisy
me
Ridley.
Too.
I can
yes.
see the film already.
I can't wait to see
Blockbuster, summer 2020. So,
anyway.
Unfortunately, the truth was a lot more uptight than that. At least
right,
what was recorded.
Right.
But they, essentially over the course of about 6 years, she made cheese. He took the measurements, and they came to a very acid-driven understanding of what makes cheddar tick that we
okay.
continue up to this day.
Okay.
But the interesting thing is, if you look at the actual way they were making cheddar, it was very different than
mm-hmm.
what we think of artisan Somerset
mm-hmm.
cheddar now.
Mm-hmm.
The process was much slower. They weren't using starter cultures at all, so they were depending entirely on the
mm-hmm.
overnight pre-ripening of the milk. And it was
Is
much...
the picture
no,
in
that's...
the book...
So,
her cheese?
No,
or
that's actually from about 25 years later. That's Dora Saker.
Oh,
so
okay.
she was working
okay.
in 1917.
Okay.
But again, I would say that those two makes are much more related than the,
mm-hmm.
than either of them
mm-hmm.
is to the cheddar that's made today. So much less heat driven and much more to do with developing acidity in order to push the whey out
mm-hmm.
of the curd and to drain
mm-hmm.
it properly. And so the nice thing about, or the, one of the interesting things about Edith Cannon is that she was based, her family farm was actually next door to where the Calvers at Westcombe Dairy make their cheese today.
Oh.
So, you know, they are really in the heart of
oh, great.
Somerset cheddar country. And I think Tom, having seen pictures and, you know, heard about Edith Cannon,
mm-hmm.
was interested in going back and re-exploring this make in the context of his family's
mm-hmm.
dairy. And
well,
is he going to do it? Has he started?
He has started experimenting with the Cannon cheddar, and it's very interesting, you know, how you recreate one of these old things is a very interesting question.
Right.
And it's very interesting because I had the chance to go and...
How well are the recipes written?
Well, that's one big thing, you know. Cannon and Lloyd, they took a lot of measurements.
Yes.
And they wrote down a lot of things. But the truth is that to recreate, to try to, okay, here you have a vat of milk, now we're going to recreate what they're doing, it's
right.
not at all clear. And so much of, really, the problem with Lloyd's research at large is that when you try to reduce the process of making cheese to a description and a set of numbers... Those do not
right.
capture.
Do not totally capture
the touch
right.
and the feel
the, yeah.
of what's going
yeah.
on.
And she sounds like she was a genius.
And, well, I think
at,
this,
in terms of touch and feel,
exactly.
as someone
and
who
and
was
all
who
the
was
stuff
in,
that
who was
can't be
in her early 20s in the early 1890s.
Right.
She actually lived through. So there are many people alive today who met her, in that she was alive through to the 1960s.
Oh. She was.
Yes.
Oh, because she was so young.
Because she was so young. So
oh,
she
that's,
was.
That
was,
gives me goosebumps.
Yeah. She was. She married and she became Mrs. Sage. But
uh-huh.
if you read.
Oh, right, I saw that somewhere.
There's a wonderful source, a sort of a propaganda guide to encourage people to be patriotic and eat British cheese from the
mm-hmm.
1950s. And that talks about the joy of talking with Mrs. Sage, who is the great cheddar guru.
Grandmother of cheddar.
Yes, and you know what I wouldn't give to bring back Mrs. Sage today and actually make cheese with her.
Yeah.
Because even within those reams of notes... We're missing something that
yeah.
really unlocks the secrets of that.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where
and
I think...
And who knows what the milk was like.
No, absolutely. And this
you know,
is the other thing. You could do exactly the same process to modern milk and come up with a completely
right,
different
right.
end product. This is one of the places where I think Havid in West Wales is so exciting because they are taking the slightly later Dora Saker method and trying to work their way into a coherent understanding of that cheese. And actually, a lot of work is going on not just at the cheese level, where I think they're doing amazing things. Rob is a fantastic cheesemaker, but also on the milk side. So Nick Millard, their herdsman, is doing a lot. They don't use any chemicals in the milking parlor. They're using wood wool rather than any sort of paper towels or washing to clean the udders.
Mm-hmm.
And really going, you know, trying to
take it back as
take
far
that
as they
back
can.
As well. Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Now, to really recreate that pre-modern milk, I think it takes even more than that. And one of the great challenges with cheesemaking in that way, in the Edith Cannon way or the Dora Saker way, is that you have to make cheese every single day in season.
Right.
And unfortunately, at the scale that Havid is, because they're quite small, the cost of labor of making cheese every day is just absolutely prohibitive. Their costs are already really high. So they are making cheese every other day, which allows them to make small batches
rather
than tiny ones.
But isn't he getting money from other sources to be able to keep going, that guy?
Let me think.
Are you talking about Andrew Hatton?
Oh, maybe I'm
going
back
down.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
So I think at least with Havid, where they're making about 25 or 30 tons of cheese a year, which sounds big, but it's actually really tiny.
Mm-hmm.
They can't afford to make cheese every day.
Okay.
It's just the labor cost is too great. So they have to refrigerate their milk, and again, that's one more thing
that is. You don't know how the cows have changed. You don't know how the meadow has changed.
Absolutely.
You know, there's some things that were not written down.
One of the interesting things to see, where we have a very definite idea of what cheddar is now, is looking back even as early as the 1890s, is this time of intense intellectual entrepreneurship on the part of various different people who all have their proprietary method for how cheddar should be made that produces dramatically different results.
Mm-hmm.
So they were all competing with each other. The eventual actual winner was the Scottish method.
Mm-hmm.
So whisper it quietly next time you meet Jamie Montgomery, but he makes Scottish cheddar. He doesn't make Somerset cheddar.
No, I mean, that is, Scottish cheddar today is Somerset cheddar. But I mean, it just goes to show that really, if you go back 100 years, cheddar was a massively diverse group of cheeses, all made in a general area, and today's, you know, that day's cheddar could have included cheeses that we would think of as probably more similar to Lancashire, you know, the full range. And today, unfortunately, because when you only have three producers, you get a population bottlenecking effect.
Right.
And so I think one of the things...
And an expectation from the consumer also.
Yeah, exactly.
They want their cheddar to taste a certain way.
Exactly, and that is the true taste of Somerset artisan cheddar, and today that is the true taste of Somerset artisan cheddar, but I think it masks that there was a huge diversity there that we've forgotten.
Mm-hmm. Well, one other thing, there's so many things, is I don't think many people know, though I think I knew it from reading Gordon's books, is how we took over America cheddar, went to England and took over and ruined your cheddar business.
What I would say is American,
story.
The idea of what we think of as modern cheddar, particularly traditional British artisan farmhouse cheddar with its cloth binding,
that cloth binding is an
innovation from the northeastern United States.
Right, to make it on the boat.
Exactly.
Like, I mean, I did not realize that. So
it's pretty mind-boggling to read this account from 1872 of the American.
Yes,
who comes...
and they were suspicious. Like, what is this cloth?
Yeah,
like,
absolutely.
What is going on here?
That the person in the restaurant who had tasted this great cheese could not be convinced that it was an American cheese until he was shown the cloth binding on the cheese.
Uh-huh.
And then he was like, okay, it's an American cheese.
Uh-huh.
And just to think of that foreign world, you know, it flies in the face of everything that we've ever been told about
what
cheddar is.
Right, And that American cheese was dominant
British market.
Yes, and then faded again.
That American factory cheese killed Somerset cheddar in a lot of ways.
Well, and the decisions, the cheapness of the British consumer in favoring, because it's interesting when people talk about it, about those first, early era of American imports, is that they talk about, well, the American cheese, it's not very good, but it's very cheap.
Yeah. The cheapness, not the sheepness.
The consumer.
No, quite
the opposite. The consumer favored
the cheap.
The cheap.
Yeah. And even though it came all the way over, those costs didn't make it more expensive.
Which
That's
is incredible.
Crazy.
Well, we live in an era of globalization. I think it's an interesting
well, that was
thing.
Early globalization.
You see is that the exactly. first peak of globalization is immediately before the First World War.
Right. Right.
And certainly the UK, London, where we live, is mm-hmm. a great imperial metropole where
right.
you could buy
right.
things from all around mm-hmm. the world.
Yeah. But the other thing that killed British farmhouse cheese was the liquid milk market, was that farmers could get a really good price for selling their liquid milk as soon as they made it. And
now, is that because of tea?
Yeah.
This is my theory.
Cheap factory cheese. It's funny.
There was milk to be... They needed milk to be drunk.
They needed milk to be drunk. The mm-hmm. milk market was booming. The dairy industry was booming. You mm-hmm. could get a great price for that liquid milk. Who in their right mind would make cheese?
Is it because Britain is so much smaller than America? Like, so that it took more cows to feed everybody?
I think with the... America in the latter stage of the 19th century has lots of land that is cheap.
Mm-hmm.
But very limited supply of trained labor.
Mm-hmm.
And so because one cheese maker can make quite a lot of cheese,
mm-hmm.
The idea of bringing together the milk from multiple farms to be processed by a single individual
mm-hmm.
really, really took off, which gave you a tremendous economy of scale.
Mm-hmm.
And also meant that because you suddenly had the trained professional who all they did was make cheese, that it was easier for them to adopt innovations. The British cheese making, because it was highly diversified and very much at the farmhouse level,
mm-hmm.
it was tricky to persuade, often for very good reason,
mm-hmm.
the British farmer's wife
mm-hmm.
that she could do something differently. Often their resistance would be, but I make a better cheese.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas the market became decided on that on price.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Yeah.
Hmm.
So, yeah.
Well, this is just there are so many topics in your book. I didn't even broach half of them, but we'll have to end. Maybe when you come back, we'll meet again and talk more.
We'd love to. Absolutely.
Yeah, that would be great. So, I want to say goodbye for this week's Cutting the Curd. We're discussing reinventing the wheel. Bronwyn and Francis, thank you so much. This has been a great talk.
Thank you so much. Indeed, this is great.
Thank you very, very much for having us here.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.